It's Friday the 29th of May and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration, and we're still running our special series on the COVID crisis because this crisis does not seem to go away. And I'm with my co-host Abby Steele, and I'm speaking to you from a particularly dark place today because for the last 5 weeks I've been getting through lockdown with the company of Michael Jordan and The Last Dance. And this series has only just ended.
I don't know what
and,
to do.
And Abby, I have nothing to do anymore. I have nothing to talk
about. I'm really
about.
Like grasping for like what can replace The Last Dance for me. It's like really, it reminds you of the original loss also. So then it brings up like a lot of old feelings
right.
as well. Also the loss of the ridiculous, let's say proportions of male formal wear in the 90s.
Yeah.
These gigantic yeah. suits and teeny tiny necktie knots. I mean, maybe we could resurrect that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jason,
yeah.
you can jump in already if you want.
Yeah, I mean, I'm up to, I think, episode 7. So I've got like, you know, the
right.
last 3-4 mouthfuls of this delicious dinner to still
You've
eat.
Got to slow walk it. You've
sorry if that makes
that.
You guys jealous.
Oh, man.
I have a theory about the whole thing, right? Is that, like, I'm not, like, this is not a conspiracy theory, but, like, Michael Jordan is both amazing basketball player and marketing genius. And I think he has managed to orchestrate a situation where he effectively gets to win the NBA championship 4th or 7th time in the hiatus created by COVID. Yeah, basically, we're watching the NBA finals and Jordan's there winning it, right? Because there's nothing else on.
I like it. I like that theory.
But Abby, you also have some personal experience of like... Of trauma.
No, it's just, it was reminding me of being in high school and being like a mediocre, skinny white girl and like trying to... Like, I thought that the way to shoot a jump shot was actually, like, a fadeaway, like Jordan used to shoot. And my coach had to, like, break it to me, like, that's not gonna go for you. Like, you cannot, that is not gonna work. Like, don't do that. And it was like, oh yeah. All right. I guess I'm not comparable to him. I should not learn my technique from Michael Jordan.
If it comforts you in any way, skinny brown boys were getting the same advice in Australia that you were getting in Cleveland.
Yeah.
But let me introduce Jason Bauer. He's already on the show, right? And I'm not going to just line this up with a series of Aussie friends of mine, but when I thought of doing this podcast series, Jason came to mind because he is a pharmacist by training. He's worked for a number of years for Mary Stopes International in their public and international public health campaigns, and has been heavily involved in the delivery of pharmaceutical products during viral outbreaks and during epidemics. And so I just thought like he was precisely the sort of person that, in addition to all my political science friends, I wanted to hear from. And to get some sort of expertise that like Abby and I just really don't have on the
just
table.
Like a fadeaway.
So
I
Jason
also have
Walker.
No expertise
yeah.
in anything pharmaceutical.
Welcome, Jason.
Thanks, Tom.
You're
thanks,
Abby. As I understand, on a farm in Shropshire of all places.
Yeah, we've done well out of the coronavirus lottery. We ended up in a very lovely place, where I can both work indoors and outdoors going on lovely walks along the canal and, yeah.
So the one thing I really wanted to get your impression on was, the way and the likely changes that we're going to see, in the supply of pharmaceuticals as a result of this crisis. I mean, we know and we've been told, we're starting to get some sort of information about what's going to happen and what our expectations should be in relationship to a vaccine. But I mean, from your perspective as someone who's been involved in the delivery, in thinking about supply chains, what do you see as the sort of key issues and problems that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, thanks, Dar. I think what I work on day to day is particularly the quality of medicines and medical products, and that's like many other things, something which I think is there's going to be attention diverted away from. I think the whole coronavirus crisis that we're in the middle of is really great at diverting us away from all of the really important things that we normally do towards what's really relevant only for coronavirus. And I think one of the biggest risks there in terms of medical supplies is that there's already lots of struggles and difficulties ensuring that people, particularly in low-income countries, get medicines that they need, get medical products that they need, and that's going to be a lot harder in this context. But yeah, as I said, particularly the quality of those products, it's we're now currently facing this potentially facing a perfect storm in conditions that really make it very risky for a significant increase in the numbers of poor quality and fake medicines and other medical products, and we're starting to see that already. So that's something that I've been particularly keeping my eye on, and something which I think is a particular concern here.
Can you explain a little bit more, Jason, why it is the case that coronavirus may make it worse than usual? And just to clarify, so you're talking about all kinds of medicine, not just treatments associated with COVID-19,
Yeah.
right?
Exactly. Yeah, there's I mean, we can certainly talk about treatments and vaccines for coronavirus, and I'm sure we'll get onto that, but
Yeah.
really what this all affects is much broader than that. We're really facing huge supply crises, and I don't think we've really started to see that just yet. We're in this early phase where people are still stocked up with medicines. Anybody who's, managing a supply chain needs to make sure that they've got adequate supplies on hand to manage situations like this. But if it becomes a prolonged situation, then we really start to see the impact of that. And so what we've got now is a rising demand, I think, for certainly for a lot of the more critical care products. We've got people hoarding. But at the same time, we've got this fall in supply. Lockdowns have resulted in huge disruption in production in a lot of the manufacturing countries. And if we then look at places like China and India and even Italy, these are big manufacturing countries where a lot of our active ingredients, the things that go inside medicines, come from, particularly China and also to a smaller extent Italy, and then our producers as well, who put those final products together in India and other places, like they've all seen huge slowdowns in production. And what that means then is that we start making these conditions that will lead to more poor quality medicines and more fake medicines. It's if criminals who like want to make fake medicines really work on the principle of going into low risk, trying to find areas where they can sell things with low risk, but with high profits. And when there's local shortage of really important products, that's when there's a really higher risk there, and they've got the opportunity to fill that gap with poor quality products and fake products. So it's really a tough situation. We've got all of the supply shortages means that we're got higher costs of products, higher costs of the active ingredients, higher costs of the raw materials, and then that puts a more of a squeeze on legitimate manufacturers. Their profit margins are lower. They need to cut corners. They might divert from manufacturing one product to trying to manufacture others, which they think are going to be which they think are going to be of more interest, but those medicines they might not be suited to manufacturing or be qualified to do it. And then all at the same time, what we've got in countries, I mean, the people who regulate medicines are those people who regulate the manufacturers in the countries that they manufacture. And then also the regulators in the countries where the products are going to be used. And both of those regulators are facing huge pressures now, and they're not able to do their jobs properly. They've had all of their resources be diverted towards this situation, and they can't get out there and look at manufacturers and assess products properly. And so we've just got this perfect storm for a lot, a lot more poor quality and fake medicines to occur.
This is great. I mean, like, in that it just makes me think about pharmaceuticals in an entirely different way to what I have been during this crisis, which is precisely doing that. It's just having my eye totally on this one ball and not recognizing that, that there are all these interlocking systems that are creating all of these challenges. Do you get the sense that, like, the WHO or the European Union or big actors have this sort of sensibility and are aware and are following these developments, or are they also similarly distracted by the shiny object?
I mean, I think honestly and understandably, they're distracted. Yeah, this really comes down to, okay, how well have we set up these systems and these is monitoring for quality already? And we want to fall back on what those systems are, but unfortunately, what we're falling back on is quite weak regulatory systems in a lot of countries. And then people like WHO and EU. EU agencies and countries are all quite aware of this, but I think understandably their attention's now on fighting this pandemic. And so yeah, I think that's and then you've got poor old WHO having to put out fires such as threats to withdraw entire funding from the US, their main funder, and there's a huge diversion of attention away from all of the critical routine ongoing medical, public health needs in countries. And it's not just about coronavirus, of course, and it's not just about it's about all different medical programs that can potentially be affected here. So and as I said, I think there's a significant lag in this as well. Certainly in terms of medical products, the supply chains, people are stocked up with active ingredients still, but now that they really need to buy those the cost of those has gone up to be prohibitive. And so, yeah, it's really going to impact on these supply chains going forward. It's already starting to.
So that's alarming to hear, because suddenly I start to imagine all sorts of medicines that people need on a regular basis, and the prospects for them to get good quality versions of what they really need to stay healthy. So it sounds like that's a really looming problem that we weren't aware of until we spoke to you. So, thanks for that. But also, I wonder if you could then still talk to us about how this looming sort of bigger problem with medicines dovetails or not to the sort of attempts to find medicines that can treat patients with COVID-19 and also potentially divert existing medicines. As we know, President Trump likes to hawk his own or make his own medical recommendations about the medicines people should be taking to treat themselves. He recently asked if he should be taking insulin also, which was, I don't know if you saw that. He wants to take all the medicines. But as an actual trained expert, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, so we have a supply chain challenge around the corner. And then there's also this idea of, like, existing medicines that might also be helpful for treating COVID-19 patients or the development of new medicines. Can you try to help us understand, like, the whole how these things relate to each other. I don't know. Just help us.
I maybe help in a small, to a small extent, but yeah.
You can see
I mean,
we need a lot of help, so any help is welcome.
Yeah, I mean it's a huge problem, and I think those as we can see all of this whole 24/7 news cycle. And the rise of social media means that we're in this situation where everything is finally watched. Every little potentially good news story that comes out about a product or a potential cure is talked about and is distributed broadly. And I think we've got this mass of misinformation which is just accumulating and accumulating. Right. And that creates huge problems there for, rational drug use, as we say, people using things appropriately, safely, people going to try and, if they're concerned that they can't get these medicines, then they'll go to unregulated supply chains to buy them. They'll buy things on the black market. And we see this proliferation of...
Just wait, Jason, when you say people will do that, do you mean governments? Do you mean hospitals? Do you mean like medical professionals? Will look for these different options?
I think it's both. I mean, I mean, both meaning not just the regular people, the health systems who normally buy these products, but also individuals themselves. There's all these parallel supply chains through black market and buying things online, which now exist, and it's very hard to regulate all of that. So we've got that problem, and people making their own decisions about using potentially inappropriate medicines. That's dangerous. And then we've also got governments who are forced because of availability and cost. They only have limited resources already, and then the cost of medicines generally and medical supplies are going up to such an extent that they have to then also go potentially to other unregulated suppliers. And again, that's another big issue in terms of the quality of those products.
So you're concerned about the misinformation?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, misinformation is it's really hard. It's you've got the president of the most influential country in the world giving very inappropriate drug advice to people. And that kind of thing is happening at a huge scale. So that's another crisis in itself. Certainly, when we come back to like potential treatments and vaccines, there's so much hype around everything, and I think the expectation there is that there's going to be a silver bullet which comes along, and we're going to have a cure that we can knock it out with. One of these treatments that we're testing are going to turn out to be effective, and everything's going to be okay and we can go back to normal. It feels like there's a lot more optimism than is warranted, as far as I can tell. Certainly, that's the hope of what a vaccine would deliver. And a vaccine obviously means that if it's effective, if we can upscale the production of the vaccine and distribute it effectively, we can really get on top of this crisis. Absolutely, but reality with vaccines is that they take an awful long time to develop normally. They take a long time to prove that they're safe as well as being effective.
How long on average does it take to develop and make sure a new vaccine is safe enough?
Yeah, well, typically and historically, average would be perhaps 10 years. We've seen that come down to probably as low as 4 years. To do before. But what we're looking at right now and what we're hoping for is that we can somehow do this in the course of 12 to 18 months, and that's a huge, huge challenge. And I do feel optimistic that we'll be able to develop a vaccine for coronavirus, for this strain of coronavirus. But because we've got so many people working on it and this huge resources have been allocated towards it. But it's not definite, and it might take a long time. And all of the individual little news stories that we say of, oh, there's a little positive result or something that looks like it might be helpful, has such ripples in the public domain that really keeps people focusing on what I think is a little bit of a distraction, and that's what's going to be the cure, the magic bullet for this whole thing. And I think similarly, if you look at treatments, we don't have any drugs which target coronavirus directly. We just don't have that. We don't have that in the way that we have it for HIV medicine, in the way that we have it for influenza, in the way we have it for any number of different bacterial infections and fungal infections and whatnot. We just don't have that for coronavirus. And so what we're looking at currently are options which are really not great options. And they're repurposed drugs that are used for other things that might show some promise in reducing the severity, hopefully reducing the number of people that die from coronavirus. But I think what we're expecting in terms of success is very modest. It's not high rates of success. It's not like the plague where we've got antibiotics where we know they're going to be 90% effective, 90% likely to stop someone from dying. I think with the options that we've got on the table, we've got at best like a 25% likelihood of reducing death. So we're really not dealing, treatments are not looking great as far as I'm concerned. And so all of this focus on treatments and vaccines to me takes the focus away from some of the more important things in managing this situation.
Well, that sounds like a good segue. Oh,
You
sorry,
could
Darshan.
you use the
Well, I
segue
was gonna say,
around me.
so what are some things, more important things you think we should be focusing on?
It's difficult to say. I mean, we have to focus on coronavirus management absolutely, and it's critical. It's one of the biggest crises we've had in the last few decades, of course, and it merits the attention that it does. But it's creating, for me personally, I feel like it's creating this nationalistic impulses. Certainly, and that's something that which we need to really push against. Certainly, in the medical domain, we need to really need to come together on all in this situation. In terms of science and research, we need to work together collaboratively, and we see lots of the usual interests pushing against that to make sure that their countries are looked after, or the people who, the lobbyists who support the politicians are similarly, being pushing for things like sharing of resources of information, of scientific evidence to be squashed as it normally has. But at the same time, I guess what we're seeing is it's this, potential collaboration that's coming, that's pushing in a different direction, which is really exciting. I mean, there's great opportunity in this that we can work collaboratively, and things like the development of a patent pool for medical science to help us with the development of treatments and vaccines and anything related to managing this problem and others. That's hopefully promising. I think it was last week, the World Health Assembly came together and has effectively signed an agreement to go ahead with developing a patent pool, which is a really promising development.
Can you just tell us, our listeners, what a patent pool is and why it would be important in this case?
Yeah, well, for intellectual property, I'm not an expert in, but But when it comes to medicines, they're always subject to patents. When we develop new medicines, they get a like a 20-year patent, which stops other manufacturers or other people from making those drugs. But it doesn't just apply to medicines, it applies to all of the science that goes into developing those medicines. And so when we come to a global health crisis like this, as we have for other things like HIV, those patents and those restrictions on sharing information, because of patents, really slow down progress, scientific progress and scientific research. And so there's in WTO's regulations, there are some allowances that are made for sharing information and using flexibilities in those regulations, which can be applied in the need in public health emergencies. And there's traditionally been a lot of pushback from the wealthy countries, and particularly those countries that have a big pharmaceutical industry in them. There's
Like the
typically been a lot of
US.
pushback there, like the
The
US,
US and Switzerland,
Switzerland,
right?
yeah, even like the UK.
Let's name
Yeah.
names.
Yeah. And those guys, well, those guys water down these agreements, and we've had but we've, a promising development is this is this move towards actually having a patent pool, an international patent pool that can, that means that information research, data is shared across countries and across, well, for everybody, so that we can hopefully find, develop these vaccines more quickly, find suitable treatments and whatnot. So.
What's the potential? I mean, I have limited faith in states and multilateral organizations being able to get together on this issue. But I mean, one of the heartening things that I've listened to in the recent last few weeks was a podcast with a local health professional, Alex Friedrich, who's been like very, popular in the Netherlands and in pioneering Groningen's response. And he was talking about this experience of during the crisis, just, picking up the phone and speaking to medical professionals in Italy and his colleagues, and being able to get up-to-date information without having to rely on other systems of knowledge transfer. I mean, when what is the other are there other examples of the way in which there's a sort of a parallel system amongst medical professionals, amongst pharmacists who share information without having to go through all of this this taxing and money-making sort of systems for managing knowledge about healthcare?
Yeah, it's a tricky one because there's those systems are, it's not just about development of pharmaceuticals, but like certainly the global knowledge, medical knowledge, our global evidence base on what's effective and what works and what's safe. It's taken a long time to develop this excellent system that we have, really. And it's based on peer-reviewed, like legitimate, like it's based on the need to demonstrate proof, to demonstrate effectiveness. That's a difference in something is significant. So I actually there's I guess it's really good seeing that there's being information shared. We see that example, for example, coming out of France, where they thought that anti-inflammatories were potentially harmful in people with severe illness from coronavirus. And then that got shared around, and so a lot of people responded to that by using those products less, and maybe that's been helpful. But there was also, equally, there's been concern about certain antihypertensives that people thought was also potentially detrimental in severe illness. But what that meant, and that information got shared from, one health professional to the next, and but what that's also ended up seeing is that people have stopped taking those medicines when they should be taking those medicines, and then the impacts of that information sharing route is potentially detrimental. So whilst those chains of communication for medical, what's effective in terms of medicines seems appealing and seems useful, the systems that we've got in place are there for a reason, and we can certainly accelerate things as WHO is doing with their solidarity trial. They're seeking to run a trial that would normally take years in, in months to get information that really proves are these medicines effective? Should we be focusing on them? And so we can accelerate that if we really try to, but that system of what's effective is there for a reason. It's a very well developed, scientifically rigorous system, and I'm as a medical professional, I'm quite defensive of it.
You're buying it.
Yeah, and I'm quite wary of
Yeah.
other routes of information, because really that's where misinformation spreads.
I wonder if you could help us, for our listeners, I met Jason when he was living in Swaziland and I was living in South Africa, and Jason was doing a lot of the work on the HIV/AIDS and antiretroviral rollout, right, in Swaziland. And also there was a sort of a similar misinformation perfect storm, right, in that you had a traditional reliance on traditional medicines and healers on one side. You had government officials providing a lot of misinformation about what works, whether it's indeed a crisis, particularly in the South African context. And Mbeki with his famous claims about the conspiracy theories around HIV/AIDS. And like, I'm wondering if you're seeing any parallels, or do you have lessons learned from that experience?
Well, certainly the parallels are in, yeah, the levels of the misinformation. We've got, I guess, social media means that everybody's got access to, and the internet means that everybody's got access to information, and what proliferates is are those stories, are those rumors. Whereas that kind of stuff in Swaziland might have been passed in communities from individual to individual. What we see in this in the more modern context, 20 years later or 15 years later. Sorry, Dar.
We're not
We're not quite that old.
that
Yeah, but we see the information age and that those same myths propagate really easily because we've got a yeah, because they can through social media and sources that are unchecked and this whole clampdown on fake news and what's actually true and real means that people just don't trust information that they receive. And that means that they've also lost trust in in good quality medical information, which has been so carefully gathered. So,
So it also seems
yeah,
like it's so difficult because, I mean, I don't know about the parallels with HIV/AIDS, but as an American, I just have a perspective on it that it took so long to get any reaction. It wasn't seen as a real epidemic in the US or, worthy of research funding for such a long time. And this is like just the inverse of that, right? There's so much attention. There has to be results now, and yet there's still, it seems just almost unreasonable to ask scientists to come up with very much information so quickly with so little known about the virus. So you can sort of see on the one hand, like the impulse to take like any new anecdote and then say, oh, is this a new symptom? Or, is this really how the virus is working? And then, I mean, it sounds like a fascinating, like a morbidly fascinating virus, also, as a completely non-expert person, right? Just reading different stories about how children are not really affected, and some people are barely affected, maybe, and then some people can have these complete, until they die, right? So it just, as an outsider, again, totally non-expert person, it seems like such a strange challenge and such an intense one. And you can see that it would contribute to a lot of potential misinformation, right? There's like just so different than other things we have faced.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I think it's proportionate. It kind of relates, I think, to the levels of fear. When HIV came out, there was a huge amount of fear in the population, and over time they're like, oh no, actually this actually isn't so risky to me because I'm not sleeping around, or I don't I'm not a gay male. It seemed like it was a the gay male plague, and then it became a problem which then affected other countries, which so I think, and it wasn't easy to find a treatment to that, but it was also a slow moving one. It was like people, once they become infected, tend to survive for 5 to 10 years. So it wasn't this big crisis that we're seeing right now, where it's a fast moving virus which can potentially affect everybody, and so every man, woman and child in or and those of non-binary persuasion all over the world are potentially at risk of this, and so what that means is we've got this heightened fear, and it's that which I think is really dictating so much of how we're responding to this and how we've diverted our attention from so many other things. It's all of these other critical public health programs that we that must keep going. They've all been diverted away from that to this one specific thing that it does affect potentially everybody. Although if we look at the statistics, of course, it's going to be more severe than normal influenza, but not a lot more severe. And it's certainly the at-risk populations who are most affected there. Whereas for younger, healthier individuals, the very few people are going to be significantly affected in their health. It's easy to hear all the stories of people that have been, of young people that have actually succumbed to the virus. But for the large majority of the population, things will go on. And so but the threat is there, and there's this growing fear which has been propagated, by
And do you
the
think,
world we live in, the information world.
I mean, I know when, like the UK, the initial response was sort of, we're just going to have to let it go through the population. And this was also the response in the Netherlands, and then walked back pretty quickly. Do you think that should have been pursued because of the sort of the level of risk of the virus, or do you think it makes more sense to do what now that the countries have gone and done, like to try to shut things down and
Yeah, I mean, I think it is being pursued, and maybe that was that was the plan from the outset. Obviously, the messaging that comes out from politicians is what's required to what's going to be politically palatable, but also what's needed for to have the impact on the public behavior that's required. But I think, realistically, the virus was already in the community in such great numbers in Europe that we've got to a point where it's really not possible to eradicate it in the same way that it might have been in Australia or New Zealand, where they're isolated and can close the borders. But it's really there. It's present. It's going to keep going. It's going to go on. There's no end in sight, really. As I said, vaccine could be a thing that stops it, but it's going to take a long time to get there. So I think
I think everyone's fixated on this idea that by Christmas we're going to have a vaccine, and like that's, such a crazy expectation,
I mean,
right?
it's possible. It's just not very realistic.
Yeah.
And I think we have to take appropriate steps to manage this in the way that's going to stop, the huge loss of livelihood of millions of people who lose their jobs, who lose their incomes, of who are suffering mental health crises due to this. And I think what governments are starting to do now with easing the lockdown is it's not they're not saying it overtly, but They're effectively accepting that the virus is going to continue through the population. We're going to be moving towards herd immunity, and whether that happens before we have a vaccine or not is another question. But I think that's probably what's going to happen. And yeah.
Have you seen, I mean, so basically, I mean, like, as I read it anyway, there's a huge political divide over this issue, right? And the moment in certain quarters, if you mention the notion of herd immunity, you're a killer.
Yeah.
And a reprehensible killer. And on the other side, it's like, you know, a freedom for everyone. Don't infringe upon my ability to go down and get my hair cut and my ice cream, right?
Yeah.
And it seems to be like I'm just wondering whether you're seeing anyone who is talking about these issues in a, or like a model of any government that you're seeing that's managed this public relations exercise of explaining these sorts of concepts and ideas in a way that may be palatable or not. Have they all just screwed it up in the way in which the UK government did when they had to walk back those remarks?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you guys are probably more experts than I on the politics of how this is playing out in different countries. But I mean, it seems to me that there's been interesting cases in like Japan, for example, where they haven't gone into these full lockdown. They haven't had the authority to do that, but they've had, you know, they've proceeded. You know, people have been fairly good at following instructions there, but also they've been able to identify those areas and those places where virus does tend to proliferate and spread more than others, and they're focusing on that. You've got Germany, who's taken a bit of a, they've had a what seems to be a more successful response to the pandemic or the epidemic there. But yeah, I'm not sure. It sounds like the Netherlands has taken a similar approach to that of the UK, and I'm not sure if it became as unpalatable to people, to the general population there, as it has in the UK. It really comes down to how you talk about it, and yeah, interested to hear.
I think people have been, I think, I mean, certainly the government is supported. The prime minister is quite popular now, and his popularity has increased since all of this has started. I think they're willing to say, yeah, it's a crisis. So they have some kind of leeway, even though, you know, the initial response was one way and then they adapted and changed. But you know, I think I would, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just because I have a group of friends who are also immigrants here, and we tend to be more critical, I think, of how this has been handled. and especially there's a very high trust among Dutch people in their government, and so, but you know, I have none of that trust, for example. I'm just sort of like, why are they doing that? Why are they doing that? Why aren't they doing this other thing? So for example, the mask wearing here, it doesn't happen. And not only does it not happen, but the rationale for not recommending it, other than requiring it on public transportation, is that they say, well, people will become too relaxed, and they think they're going to be protected. Or, you know, it doesn't really work that well anyway,
right.
But then they're making people wear it on public transportation, which is confusing. So just that example to me is sort of, well, what is your rationale? If you recommend it because we are in close proximity, then we should also be wearing it in a lot more indoor circumstances, at least, right? Like in grocery stores or this kind of thing. But, but yeah, no. We don't have that.
Yeah, well, masks are tricky, aren't they? I mean, it's a good example of something where you can really see both sides of the argument, and so that it hasn't come out as a clear recommendation on it. It's hard to have that, and I think the debates will be ongoing because it's, in some ways, it seems they can be effective, but the arguments that they're not as effective as hoped, and also that people are more relaxed, I think are probably legitimate ones. So, yeah.
All right, fine. I'll
Coming back
trust
to
them a
the.
little bit more. Fine. Stop complaining so much, I guess.
No, but I mean, like for the non-experts, it's hard to work, to sift through all of this knowledge and develop, you know, when you know as well that so many of these decisions are either driven by politics or economics in some other way. And then you look, I mean, particularly as Abby and I've been doing in this podcast, is like touring around and seeing all of these different examples of how things work elsewhere, like particularly like places like South Korea or Singapore, where they seem to have a little bit more both social knowledge about how to act and behave in these contexts, but also political and public health interventions that they can draw upon and utilize that seem to have had some effect. And then to be in this context where it's kind of like, oh, we're just,
Well,
you know, trying to work it
they're like
out.
reinventing the wheel. I think that's been the
Yeah.
frustrating experience, at least here, and what looks like the UK went through as well. Like, well, our own experts think this. And to me, the messaging
Yeah.
really sounded like there was an unwillingness to look at what other experts in other countries have learned, or to explain why certain interventions elsewhere they didn't think would work here in a way that was credible, because they would explain this in a way like South Koreans are obedient. And it's like, oh no, now you fucking lost me because, oh, sorry, maybe we shouldn't swear on the podcast. Apologies. But, you know, that's just not a credible reason to believe
Yeah.
that something won't work here.
Monday morning meetings on migration is brought to you by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can find us on our WordPress site or alternatively on Facebook or Twitter. If you have ideas about a show that we ought to feature or a guest that we ought to have on, please contact Abby or I on imes@uva.nl.